This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, you are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. The Malaysia Human Development Report is a study commissioned by the United Nations Development Programme, or UNDP. Released on November 2014, it aims to provide an independent assessment of Malaysia's development policy choices in its quest to achieve developed status by 2020. 13 national experts contributed research and insights into all aspects of Malaysia's economy. And on today's show, I'm speaking to Dr. Anis Yusol Yusof, Principal Research Fellow at the Institute of Ethnic Studies at University Kebangsaan Malaysia, about the role that civil society organizations play in cultivating an inclusive growth. Dr. Anis, you've lobbied for a human development report on Malaysia since your days at UNDP. Why did you think it was important?
It's important because we need to map out where we or what we have achieved thus far. There are many ways of capturing this achievement, and I think the Human Development Report, which is done globally and most countries have already developed their own national Human Development Report, is key because there are many components. It's not just looking from the GDP alone, the economic side alone, but this report also look from the other aspect, for example, on education. It also looks in terms of how our health services are provided. So these indicators give us an idea of the quality of life of the people in the country. So that's why I've been pushing for it, and I'm glad that finally we get to do one and to be part of the team to contribute.
When we look at inclusive growth and civil society, you know, many among us would associate civil society organizations with non-governmental organizations or NGOs. Is this a fair characterization? What are the characteristics of CSOs?
I like to not use the term non-governmental organization. You see, the non-government give the connotation, a negative connotation, because if they say NGO is non-government, then in other words, you're saying that government is a non-people organization. I think that is not what they do. Most of these CSOs, the civil society organizations, are doing things within their community, within their interests, issues on rights, issues on environment. So we have to give the terms that what they do, and I think civil society captures that. Although in Malaysia, people use NGOs, CSOs interchangeably, but I think what I try to highlight the important to say what it is, because you know, sometimes when people just look at NGO and have that negative thing, even when the NGO or the society is doing some great things, they're being seen as if they are anti something or against something. I think we have to say what it is. The term, there are many definitions internationally. You know, people talk about civil society has to be a voluntary organization. It has to be independent. It has to have a focus on issue, an issue-based type. But, you know, I think along the line, a lot of civil society started, even in Malaysia, on a voluntary basis. People get together because they believe in something and come to do to meet and work on something. But I think over time, we realize that it cannot just be voluntary. You need to get professionals to come and help with certain issue. So that's when civil society move into almost like an industry where people they employ and you pay good people, good salary, and you attract good people, and then you get good results.
When you say independence, then, are we saying that social organizations that depend on government or corporate funds, in this case, are not considered CSOs?
Well, they are. That's why if you look at the background paper that I prepared, that we categorize, there are those who are government-funded, partly because they can't live on their own. They need to get the support, and we're not saying that that's not original. They are, and part some of them are actually created by government, because the government cannot do everything. They need the support of the community, and sometimes there are certain issues needs to be tackled in a way where people nearer to the community on the ground are the one that can reach out, or even sometimes some things that are sensitive. For example, when dealing with HIV cases, and Islam religion comes into the whole picture, it's difficult for government to say that they are supporting condom distribution or syringes for the drug addicts. But civil society can help the government. So the funds being channeled through them, and they can help to reach down to the community. So I think while they are doing some important, but there are also those who wants to be independent of the government, because then they can speak up on behalf of the people. And I think we have to see that both are playing an important role. Both are community-based in their own right in the way they contribute to society.
So as you mentioned earlier, things like growth can be hard to quantify when you move beyond GDP, when you move beyond pure numbers. So how then does civil society promote inclusive growth?
Well, it depends on the kind of work they do. I think if we take, for example, those groups are working with the disabled and not just relying on government's handout, but also getting involved and getting the disabled to also contribute and participate in development. I think this is the way that we have to think. It's no longer, you know, you give, well, that's the saying of give a man a fish, he will eat the fish for a day, but if you teach him the fish. But even that proverb, I think we need to change, because sometimes even if you have the skill of how to go and fish, but if the sea is polluted, the river is polluted, then you still have problems.
There's no fish.
There's no fish. So that's extra thing. And the contribution from society, I think, helps the development. Case in point, when consumer movement started in this country, it was way back in the 60s, 70s, you know, consumer association, Penang, long time ago they started. A lot of this group, before even the government were thinking of setting up Ministry for Domestic Trade and Consumer Affairs. So because of the work that they have done in the past, that the government realized there is a need for a ministry to look after the consumers. Similarly with environmental group, the environmental group, you know, with Malaysian Nature Society, EPS, and so many of them have been around before we have ministry responsible for environment. Human rights issues also being fought by many groups before now we have Suhakam. So I think government realized that yes, there are certain things now, certain responsibility the government has to take over, but still the need for the civil society to help contribute development of the country. And I think this is where people will be brought in together moving forward. I think we need to empower the third sector. Civil society needs to be given more role for development.
Going back to where it started then, you wrote that Penang Island gave birth to activism in Malaysia, quoting Kunda Dixit of Interpress Service, that yeah, activist groups are to the island of Penang what brokerage firms are to Wall Street. Could you elaborate on this history?
Well, Kunda is an old friend. He's Nepali who basically work in Asia. When he came to visit Penang, and I think this was in the 90s, he saw the number of civil society groups mushrooming. And Penang at that time was not just hosting a number of local NGOs or CSOs, but international. World Alliance for Breastfeeding Action is based in Penang. It's still in Penang. The ITFAN, the International Baby Food Action Network, is still in Penang. So a number of these initiatives was coming out of Penang, and Penang becomes a hub where civil society activists meets every other month. And I mean, I grew up being part of this movement. And he then said, you know, this is really something that a brokerage firm in the Wall Street, and make that comparison. And he wrote that in one of this Interpress piece. So I like to think that Penang still, although every time I go back, you know, some of those activists have moved out. But I hope to take it on. And my belief is that this third sector must grow beyond just Penang, but also in other parts of Malaysia.
What was it, though, about the circumstances in Penang Island that allowed activism and CSOs to grow and thrive there?
Well, there are many indicators. If you look at history, Penang is first for many things. On top of my head, you know, oldest school, oldest newspaper, a lot of things started. And I think partly because sometimes education really helps and give people opportunity to think and what they think is right. Not just, and I think that the interesting thing is that it was not one of those anti-movement, but it was for the people. So now, somehow, I feel that people are just for the sake of, you know, to rebel or to go against, and people are forming groups. I think we have to think of what is good for the people when we come together to form a group. How can we help improve society, quality of life, and things like that?
I'm speaking today with Dr. Anis Yusel Yusof, Principal Research Fellow at the Institute of Ethnic Studies in University Kebangsaan Malaysia, UKM. We are discussing civil society organisations and how they contribute to inclusive growth. Up next, we discuss the role of the internet in all of this on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Best for money, BFM 89.9.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me, Dr. Anis Yusel Yusof, Principal Research Fellow at the Institute of Ethnic Studies in UKM. We're discussing civil society organizations and inclusive growth. So we've kind of established what happened, why civil societies are important, why civil society organizations are important, as well as perhaps how Penang Island contributed greatly to that. But how did politically motivated CSOs thrive in spite of repressive colonial era laws like the Society's Ordinance?
Well, I like to focus more on development type society. I think the political motivated, they survive no matter what, because you know, whether it's really against something that they believe in. But I think the focus that we should give and how we should see that the developmental type are the one, you know, I don't think any laws are there to stop them. You look at groups that are helping the poor or the disabled, and I think the marginalized to some extent are being helped greatly because of this group. I think Malaysians generally are very... what's the word for it? Actually, if you go and ask people for help, they're very generous, extra. We know that some those awful homes that a group of ours wanted to help out. And we found that actually the moment you just announce now with social media, people come. So I think people just want to help. And I think in that kind of spirit, it's important that civil society are given a more greater role. And even going back to the question you were asking, the political ones also must have an issue of what. It just cannot be politics alone. It has to have to take on the cost, you know, whether GST or whatever the cost that people are fighting for. But I think at the same time, responsibility must also comes in where civil society can also play a role to help explain certain things to the community on the ground. From that angle, I think there are a lot of rooms for everybody to contribute and play.
During the 80s and 90s, however, civil societies were marginalized to prioritize economic growth. Why were the two not compatible? What was the rationale given at the time?
I don't really look at that to make that comparison. I didn't have the opportunity to make. But I think it was more perhaps the importance of basic development from economic perspective that we need to develop first. If otherwise, you keep on putting pressure on things, and some people realize that what is more priority in that context. But even that, I think the people who were voicing any disagreement were still doing it, except that maybe some were arrested and whatnot. But that's the price some people have to pay for what they believe in, for being committed to a cause. I think this is sometimes you see as a problem in the country when not so much of the law, but people who enforce the law, people tend to take things in their own hand and decide what they think is right. What they think is right may not be the right thing to do. So I think we have to move on as a society, as we develop, as we grow and mature as a country. How can we develop a more participatory approach in development, bringing people together, having dialogue, We can agree to disagree on a lot of things, but why, instead of just putting one views, let's listen to the many different views. We talk about unity in diversity. I mean, Malaysia is a classic. Where else can you go to find kind of a community with multi-language, multi-religion, multi-races? But at the same time, also, we have multi-problems. And we have to face the fact we have a problem. But it's not that everything must be repressive. Everything must be, you know, people who just speak up have to deal with things. I think this is a mature society. And civil society is part of that society that keeps us alive. And why people, actually a lot of people praise Malaysia for how we were able to live in harmony for a long period. If you look at any other country with the kind of dynamics that we have, you can see that it's a lot of problem, a lot of conflicts. And we were able to deal with those. And I think that is the spirit, the positive side of how we move forward.
You mentioned earlier how some people may have to give up their liberty to a certain extent to stand up for what they believe in. And the curtailment of civil liberties was epitomized by Operation Lalang in 1987.
Yeah.
Is such a sweeping operation a possibility still today?
Well, as you know, I think the Prime Minister have repealed off the ISA, and I think it's about time. And now, I don't think that is the way to go. And that's why I started by saying that. When people say, oh, you can't touch on this, is negative. I always tell people, there are no negative issues, only negative people. It's the person who's negative, who's basically, or sensitive about things. So the sensitivity is not so much of the issue, but the people. So I think if people are willing to open up, and the world is a big place, we need to read more, we need to see, visit other countries. I think people who are sensitive are people who have not seen other countries, probably, who have never visited abroad, and or their readings are only limited to certain things. I think we have to open up. I think Malaysia is ready. We have a very educated group of society now, and social media actually helps to educate people, and radio station plays a role to help explain some of this issue. And I think we should not be afraid anymore. Some of these draconian laws in the past, I think, are gone. And if there's anything new to be introduced, I think enforcement must be responsible in using some of these tools.
And certainly, part of that opening up is the internet. Mm. How big a game changer was the internet when it came to the formation of civil societies and civil society organizations?
I think this is really something caught a lot of people by surprise, because they didn't expect the power of how internet can play. Now, in the past, if you talk about civil society, there are members, voluntary group who comes together, they have to meet, they have to be in the same place, same locality, and organize a campaign, I was involved with when we were doing the anti-tobacco campaign back then. And I can imagine, if with the present technology, how, and we can see how things goes viral. And so it's just the strategy of how civil society must also be responsible in terms. Because at the same time, you can also cause a lot of problem when you start to put information that's not without any factual, you can create unnecessary problem. But I think most civil society groups that are working on certain cause have been using the social media, using the internet as a way of community reporting. And imagine this from bottom up, and the government should take this as a positive sign, because most of our policy is very much top down. Here you have a input from bottom up. If we locate by location, you map out the whole country and you said there's some new policy going to be imposed, what do people say from the ground? and civil society groups, you know, can help to get this input. And this input becomes important for government to realign some of the policies so that it really will bring benefit to the society.
And as CSOs develop and grow larger, is more emphasis being placed on financial accountability?
Oh, certainly. I think especially those groups that talk about governance, and if they are not managing their own governance,
That's highly problematic.
because most CSOs, those issue-based, are very, you know, they speak very idealist in what they want to achieve. And I think you cannot run an organization like that where you believe in a cause and yet you're not ethical in managing your funds.
And you don't live your cause.
You don't live your cause. I think that is key. Although in the past, partly because, like I started by saying, some it's just volunteers, so you don't have professionals working within the groups. So therefore, whatever contribution people make, they just use money. But I think more and more now, all this have to be accounted for. Accountability is key. I think people would want to give money to a civil society group for a cause that they believe in, provided that it has to be managed and run properly.
Does civil society and democratization go hand in hand?
Well, it depends on what you understand by the whole democratization. If you take, for example, democratization of knowledge, you want the quality knowledge to reach throughout the country. It's not only like the best teachers or the best gurus are located in some good school, and the poor kids who goes to the remote school are not getting it. So in that context, you talk about democratization of knowledge. You want to make sure that that's where the internet can help and use, so that teachers who teach in some good school in Kuala Lumpur can use internet to also help share some of their knowledge with kids in the rural area. Now, if you talk about democratization from the political perspective, similarly, I think civil society have a role and space to play in that. The problem is that we understand more and more political literacy in Malaysia probably is not as high as we think we are. Ordinary people on the street probably don't really, I'm not saying they don't care, but probably because they are bogged down with the day-to-day life. I need to go and get some income so that I can put food on the table. Therefore, don't come and lecture me about political science 101 kind of thing. So if you ask ordinary people, I'm not sure whether people know the difference between a local assembly, a YB, and a member of parliament. They're all YB the same. So, but their role is different. If society understand better of what are these different roles, then they should demand the right. See, the problem now is that because some politicians also probably they want to be the people on the ground, they want to be everywhere. And they fail to realize, actually, if you are elected as a member of parliament, your focus, you are a lawmaker. You are in parliament to make sure that the right policies are written, and basically that certain laws will not infringe on the community, whether from your constituency or nationwide. But instead, every little problems, the constituencies would want to turn to the YB. And I think that's wrong, because there are other agencies that can play that role. So civil society, in to some extent, can help educate community also on this, and so that you channel problems to the right places, and there are people who can help. And I think in this whole democratic world, especially in Malaysia, civil society has a great role to help make this a more democratic, creating space for this to happen.
On the other hand, though, would the proliferation of religious or ethnic-based CSOs undermine the bedrock of our multiracial society?
Certainly, Lynn. I think that goes without saying. While we are promoting a multicultural society, living together in harmony, we cannot have one type of society who just want to champion their own cause. It defeats the purpose of what we have built this country, you know, after almost 58 years now. We are very fortunate to be able to live together. You know, this whole idea of creating problems is not new. Sometimes I wonder, it's like people organize this every 5 years, creating problems. But who created the problem is the question. I conducted a survey in 20 parliamentary constituencies throughout the country. And I found on the ground, the ordinary people, whether they are Ali, Achong, or Mutu, they are working together. For them, putting food on the table and getting roof over their head is important. They work together. You'll be surprised to see that, you know, see the question in that survey, we divided into three components. One, we look at quality of life, so question on education, on their income, on health services becomes key, so that people give their views on those things. The second component, we look at policies. We ask questions like, is this policy what you want? Can this policy help you? So we get feedback from the bottom. Only the third part, we look at the ethnic relation. We ask questions like, when was the last time you have a meal with a friend from a different race? I thought that because by reading the mainstream newspaper and alternate, I thought that we are going to be having a lot of problems. But actually, when we survey on the ground, and we took pictures to see, actually, that is not the real problem. It's not the real case. I can see in your office in the BFM, you have kind of multiracial, you know, staff. I'm sure you all go out for a meal together.
Of course,
so,
yeah.
And I think this is real. So my view is for those people who just want to have this one treadmill, trying to champion a certain cause, make sure it's a cause for all Malaysian, not just for certain groups. Then there's no end to the good work that a lot of people are trying to do to promote national unity. Even if we say we don't have national unity, I believe we have this national social cohesion that binds us together, that brings us together. I mean, there's something that keeps us not killing each other. I think that's important. People have to be reminded of that.
Out of close to 110,000 CSOs in Malaysia, close to 60,000 are political and religious organizations. Is this ratio normal around the world?
I haven't made any comparison. But I think generally from observation and reading, this is something that is quite, I wouldn't say normal, but it's quite common for people to come together. And even if you go to a function, if you don't see anybody that you recognize, you would want to go and approach. This is the normal thing. You will approach somebody that looks like you, who speaks your language. You know, you get attracted to things that are common. So in society also, it's like that. The social alliances or the alignment happen when they felt threatened, so they need to find places that can provide support or be with group of friends so people like, can work together. I'm more concerned that while there are all these groups put together, I think the groups that the voices of the silent majority that people have been saying that who are against this, they should come together also. The groups that who doesn't like to see the mushrooming of all this pro certain race, or, I mean, it exists in all the different races in this country, and that's the problem. So maybe people who love the country as it is, from different ethnic group, different religion, regardless of race, color, can come together and say, look, we are beyond these petty issues.
Could you give us some examples of how civil society movements have actually led to concrete social, economic, or political change?
Oh, there are so many. I think if we look at the example, the disabled group, I think they're very active. Whether the different disabled, but in terms of voicing their views, you don't see a ram in Kuala Lumpur or shopping malls even in the 90s. I remember helping organize, there was a Ministry of National Unity, Social Development at that time. The Deputy Secretary General, I remember, she organized all the senior officers to go on a wheelchair. around KL and see whether they can do their day-to-day routine, whether ATM machine used to be meant only for people who walk. What about the disabled? And not only the pressure, the awareness have now created into policy. Buildings now have to be built to certain order. So I think that is a concrete thing. As I mentioned earlier, consumer movement, the work that they have done to make government realize that we need to have ministry. There must be consumer protection. The works of the breastfeeding groups, making sure hospitals are more responsible. These are real concrete policies. All this basically came out from the hard work of this civil society group. So I think certainly more issues, more work needs to be done. Government, I think, also are open to this contribution and to work together hand in hand. That's why I said it's not non-government as against the non-people, but the government and the people should be together in this whole development game.
Having said that, though, civil societies, I mean, the examples that you cited often involved society sort of stepping up and really trying to forge, you know, their own paths towards some form of change. Looking at the other side of that relationship, are civil societies consulted often enough by government agencies?
Now, I think they are. Maybe in the past, there's a bit of a gap here and there. But I see from my dealing with some government agencies, they realize that the voices of society cannot be taken lightly, that that they are representing a group of community. And I know a lot of dialogues where it's now like almost a ritual that we need to engage. You know, you hear it from the other side, oh, we have to engage the civil society, we have to have a program, we need to build with stakeholders engagement. These are the terms that you don't hear in the past. So I think it's now happening. And with that, the civil society must step up and also be responsible in responding. Problem is some, not all, they're only looking at potential funding. Oh, then the government say, I'm calling you more for the issue that we're discussing. We don't have money also. I mean, you need to go and find your own money and to do this. So I think it has to be both ways, two ways kind of a relationship. But to your question, certainly more engagement is happening. And we hope that the engagement also not just being done as a way to just, oh, we have done it. The civil society have been engaged. Therefore, we can move on. I think not just ticking off like it's being done, but more important is that have you not just consulted, but that the whatever being raised, the views from those consultation are being taken in the policy formulation. I think that's important.
Thank you very much for your time, Dr. Anis. I've been speaking to Dr. Anis Yusal Yusuf, Principal Research Fellow at the Institute of Ethnic Studies in University Kebangsaan, Malaysia. We've been discussing civil society organizations and inclusive growth on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.